On Wednesday night, March 3rd, 8 o'clock, here in the shuls of Ace Medrash, the topic of that lecture will be the relationship between parents and children. Tonight's lecture, the topic is the relationship between husbands and wives. I'd like to introduce Rav Shechter.
In the Chumash, we read the way Avraham Avinu went to buy a burial plot for his wife, Sarah, when she passed away. And the verb that the Chumash uses is Vayikach, that he purchased the Moris HaMachpelah to bury his wife. And the Talmud comments that in Chumash Dvarim, when the Torah describes the situation of one getting married, it says, Ki Yikach Ish Isha. So we learn through Gzeira Shava, we learn through the fact that the same verb is used in both situations. Just like Avraham Avinu purchased this plot by paying money, so too a man can acquire a wife by giving Kesed Kiddushin. That's the way we're all Mekadosh and Isha. A man gives a ring to the girl, and he says, Hariyat Mekadosh Asli B'Tabazu. What's the form of Kiddushin? So the Talmud says that the principle that we employ is Shava Kesed to Kesed, since the ring is Shava Kuta. It has the status of keset, and it is the principle that we employ is shavu keset to keset, since the ring is shavu kuta. It has the status of keset, and an isha miskadeshes aide keset. So the Apikrusim always used to make fun of this passage in the Gemara, that the rabbis viewed marriage like buying real estate. You buy yourself a horse, or you buy yourself a plot of ground, plot of land, and it belongs to you. You pay money, it belongs to you. So too, the man pays money, and he buys his wife. Farmer takes a wife, and the wife is meshubet to work for her husband. So Rabbi Hirsch has an interesting comment in one of his essays in Choreif, where he writes, those who are familiar with the Talmudic language will know what this terminology means. The Talmud has two concepts, one of kinyan mamon and one of kinyan iser. Kinyan mamon means that I own a table, I own a book, I own my clothing, I own real estate, I own property. That's kinyan mamon. Kinyan iser means a different thing. I'm considered the bailim over something or somebody with respect to Issa v'Heter. The religious laws change. For example, if I own an Eved K'nayni, so I own the Eved K'nayni, he has to service me. I own a Kinyan Mamon, but I also own a Kinyan Issa on the Eved K'nayni, in that if I happen to be a Kohen, so the Eved K'nayni of mine is permitted to eat Truma. If I have an Eved Ivri, the Eved Ivri is not permitted to eat Truma just because I'm a Kohen. But if I have an Eved K'nayni, the Eved K'nayni is allowed to eat Truma. Or for example, if I possess an Eved K'nayni, he cannot become a Munah on the Korban Pesach, he cannot participate, last week's schedule we learned this in Pashas Boy, he cannot join in to become a Shutuk in the Korban Pesach without explicit permission from his Adon, from his master. And Eved Ivri, there is no such din. It's only a din in Eved K'nayni. So the Talmud calls this a Kinyan Issa. This is what we call a Kinyan Issa. So the Mefarshim on the Shulchan Aruch explained that this is a Dava Pasha, that a husband certainly doesn't have a Kinyan Mamon on his wife. He doesn't own his wife. There's even a dispute whether the husband has a kinyan isra on his wife, whether we say that the fact that the woman is asura kuli alma, that she's not allowed to run around with anyone else, is that because the husband has a kinyan isra over his wife, he owns his wife with respect to isra v'heta? Well, not at all. He neither has a kinyan moment nor a kinyan isra. It's just that the way to create the kedushin is by making a maisa kinyan. Oisha niknes, the Mishnah describes one who gets married, by making a kinyan, by giving over the transference of the ring, giving over the kesef kedushin. So it's a maisa kinyan, but the chalos, what takes effect, is neither a kinyan moment nor a kinyan issa. That's the way it's usually assumed. That's the way it's usually assumed halachically in Shulchan Aruch, that the husband certainly has no kinyan moment on his wife and doesn't even have a kinyan issa on his wife. In fact, there is a famous discussion in the commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch. There's a famous dispute between the Bnei Yeshua, that's one of the commentaries on the Talmud, and the Yavne Nebun. If I have a piece of real estate and I sell it to somebody, then a week later I sell it to somebody else. So the second sale is not valid. It didn't belong to me. I already sold it a week ago. So how can I sell the same thing again a second time? So what if a woman agrees to marry one man? A woman gets married. Then the Eishes Ish, a year later, she decides she no longer loves her husband. She wants to marry somebody else. So someone else gives her a ring a year later, and he says, Hariyat Mekudesh Asli, he wants to marry. So the Talmud says that Enki Dushin Tovsin Beishes Ish, that if somebody gives a ring to a woman who's already married to somebody else, and the first husband is still alive, and he never gave her a divorce, so the fact that she receives a ring, Kesef Kedushin, from the second man is meaningless. She's not allowed to live with him, and she doesn't need any get from the second man. She's simply not married to him. So So the Talmud derives this from a pasuk. So the Kenei Yeshua has a famous comment on the Gemara, the end of Kiddushin, where he says, this we understand very well. If I've already sold the property to somebody, so how can I sell the same property to somebody else a week later? It no longer belongs to me. So if the girl already agreed to marry the first man, so it's like she sold herself to the first husband. So she has no right to sell herself to the second husband. She no longer has the bailus on herself to give herself over to the second husband. And the Yavne Miloyim says, if you look in the Gemara, that that's clearly not correct. That has nothing to do with that. When a woman gets married, she's not selling herself to the husband. There's no kinyan mamon, there's no kinyan iser. There's a relationship of marriage. So this comment that the Apikursim always used to make fun of the rabbis of the Talmud, that they compared getting married to buying real estate, that just like Avraham Avinu purchased the Maros HaMachped by paying the right amount of money, so too a man takes a wife. If he gives the girl enough money and the girl agrees to sell herself, or gives the money to the girl's father, if the girl is a younger girl, before the age of 12 and a half. So the father has the rights over his daughter. So the father is considered as if he's selling his daughter. So Rabbi Hirsch writes that if you really understand halacha, if you know the Gemaras, you see that this is utterly ridiculous. What did the rabbis have in mind by deriving kiddushin from buying the Maros HaMachpelah? So Rabbi Hirsch says, no, there was a different thing. He says, the rabbis could have derived it from so many other psukim. What do they have to pick on this gzera shava? To learn kicha kicha from steyafim from Maros HaMachpelah? So he says, no, the rabbis wanted everybody to realize when a man gets married, he should be so in love with his wife that the love should extend for so many years, even after they've already reached an old age, and even after his wife passes away, he should love his wife to the extent that he should be prepared to spend so much money. Avimeh Shekel Kesef, Ayivah Lasech, he paid a fortune of money to buy his wife, a special Kevin Yisrael to buy the special Maros HaMachpelah out of love for his wife. That's why they derived it from that pasuk. They could have derived from many other pasuk that kiddushin could be accomplished like they kiss. But they wanted to stress this kavana that the fellow should marry his wife out of love. It's interesting, the Mishnah discusses in Ksubas an aspect of this halacha. There is a din in the Talmud that the husband is obligated to support his wife on the higher of the two standards of living. Take for example, a man is obligated, we'll get to the details a little later, a man is obligated to buy clothing for his wife. So what kind of clothing? He can buy a beautiful dress, so he can buy a shmata clothing, dungarees and pullovers. Is he mukhif to spend a lot of money to buy a fancy clothes or not? So the Talmud says it all depends what standard of living they were used to before. If he is from a wealthy family and his mother always dressed very nicely, even if she is from a poor family where they always dressed in rags, or if she is from a wealthy family where they always dressed very nicely, even if he is from a poor family, and now he marries this girl and he can afford it. If he can't afford it, can't afford it. But if he can't afford it, then he's obligated to give her the clothing on the higher standard of living. Or let's say his mother, his parents always went to Switzerland in the summertime and Eretz Yisrael in the wintertime. Or whatever, however it's supposed to be. I don't even know. So, and she, in Switzerland you go in the wintertime?
Skiing.
Okay. Now it's just on the summer. Okay. And her, that was his family. And her family, they never heard of, and they never went on vacation. They worked summer and winter. Or in her family, they always go on vacations 5 times a year. And in his family, they could never afford it, they could afford it, they never went, whatever the explanation is, his family, they never went traveling around the world. And now he's married to his wife, and he can't afford it. So the din says, Oilo imo, the elia redesimo. The Talmud derives this from the pasuk in Chumash. The husband is obligated, not obligated to waste money on his wife, but he's obligated to buy food, clothing, and entertainment for his wife, whatever, lets it to go to the theater. So his family, his father took his mother, the practice was, they always went to the theater, whatever, once a week, once a month, whatever it happens to be. And in her family, they never had such a practice. Or the reverse. So then the husband is obligated to entertain his wife, or to buy clothing for his wife, or to take her out to eat out meals in restaurants, if that was the practice. Oila ima beli yaretzimu, whichever is the higher of the two standards of living, provided that the husband can afford it. Now, the husband can't afford it, so he's not obligated. But if he can't afford it, so then he's bukhir to do this. So the Talmud has a dispute among the Tanoim. The Mishnah introduces this topic in Maseches Ksubis, in the middle of Ksubis. What about after she died? Do you still apply this principle in such a situation? Also, he's like this. In his family, whenever anybody died, they spent hundreds of dollars on a fancy burial. And in her family, whenever anyone died, you start in a nifta piftig about a cheap funeral, nothing special. Or the reverse. In her family, they made a big spiel about the funerals. In his family, they didn't. So after the let's say the couple was married and the wife dies to the husband, one of the obligations of the husband is that after she dies, the husband is obligated to bury her properly. So do you say, even in such an instance, that after she already died and the marriage is already terminated, do you still say there oila ima ve'ini eredesimoi? That you still say that he's obligated to give the higher of the two standards of living? But he say, no, that only applies when they're still married together, when they're living together. She died already. So then just mukhif to bury her, and not mukhif to spend so much money, the higher standard of the two that they happen to give, that they happen to have had previously, each family. But kozman that they're still living together as far as traveling, or as far as vacations, or as far as theaters, or as far as what style of clothing and so on, that the Talmud learns out from a pasuk in Chumash, it's a biblical requirement that the husband is clearly obligated to give his wife the higher of the two standards of living, provided he can afford it. This is what the Talmud calls the obligation of the husband to be mechabed his wife. Mechabed his wife doesn't just mean he holds the door open and he lets it go first, or he puts on her coat, or he holds the chair for her when she sits in. That's also a nice thing to do, but that's not the main. Mechabed means money, to spend money. The Gemara says the husband is mechuyev. No, that's what it says in the Talmud. The Talmud says, "Oy v'sishtoi kigufoi mechabdo yosim igufoi." The Talmud says the husband has an obligation to love his wife as he loves himself. Or mechabdo, to be mechabed his wife yosim igufoi. What do I mean mechabdo yosim igufoi? So it means that if the husband, let's say, the husband has five old suits from 6 years ago, and they're all torn, and the wife has so many dresses, the wife has 150 dresses, and then she wants to buy another dress. And the husband just got a little increase in salary, and he can afford to buy something. He can either afford to buy the wife dress number 151, or buy himself a new suit, because his suits are falling apart. So reason certainly dictates that if he's in need of a suit, more so than his wife is in need of a dress, so of course he buys himself a suit. What happens if he has a wardrobe, he has 150 suits, but she only has five shmatovic dresses? So then it's obvious, then it's understood that if he has a little money to buy something, so he buys. It's self-understood, common sense dictates. He buys for the wife. So the question is, what happens? He has enough and she has enough. And now he just earns some extra money. And they, instead of putting it away, he's interested in buying himself a new suit and she's interested in buying a new dress. So who has the kedima? So that's what the halacha says in the Talmud. Mechabdo yoisa migufoi. When it comes to mechabdo, it means to spend money on things that he would like to have, some piece of luxury. He would like to have a pipe or whatever, a fancy hat, and she would like to have something fancy, something extra. So the wife should take kedima to the husband. Doesn't mean liyoy lavoy take kedima. She gets a dress, and the next time he'll buy her a suit, and she'll buy something fancy, and he'll buy something fancy. It's not that you always favor the wife. When everything is equal, and you have some extra money to spend, so then the halacha says, mechabda yosim igufa. And in fact, the Talmud says in Bava Metzia that this is considered as gula for ashiris. If the husband will be mechabda his wife, Robert told his students, Akira Nishaihu, the husband should be mechabed their wives in the sense of spending money on their wives. They shouldn't be cheap. Kehecha de tisasra, in order that you should strike it rich. And he quoted the Pasuk in Bereshis where it says, well, Avram heitiv bavura, that Avram became a rich man in the schus of his wife. So Robert said that when a husband would spend money on his wife, mechabed his wife by spending money, this will be his gula for ashiris. Of course, the Chavetz Chaim writes in his commentary on the Shulchan Aruch that people shouldn't get carried away and think that the school of Rashiris, even if he can't afford it, even if the husband can't afford it, so let him spend an investment. The Talmud promises that you're going to get rich, so spend a lot of money on your wife and you're going to get rich and everything will be paid back. So he says that he saw many people in Europe. Chafetz Chaim lived about 100, when he wrote that part of the Shulchan Aruch, lived around 100 years ago. He died about 60 years ago. So he writes that a lot of people went out of their way to spend a lot of money. Their wives were very demanding and they spent a lot of money. And they became broke. They went broke because they couldn't really afford it. So he says, that's not reasonable. The Talmud says that a person should be careful that how much money one will earn during the course of the year is determined in Aseres and Etshuva and Tishrei. And if in Hashemayim it's determined that the man will make, let's say, $50,000 this year, he can stand on his head and take extra jobs. And it may be that the Gzerim in Hashemayim is that's it. He's only going to make $50,000. It could be the Gzerim in Hashemayim is that if he takes an extra five jobs, he'll make $25,000. Whatever, $250,000, and if he only has one job, he'll make $50,000. Or it could be that the Gzera Min HaShemayim is that's all. He's only going to make $50,000. Even if he stands on his head and he tries to earn more, he won't succeed. So the Chafetz Chaim says, the Kavon of the Gemara, that the Gemara says, the Kolman Zanois and Shalot and Ketsuvin Loi, the Rosh Hashanah, that how much one is going to earn during the course of the year is determined in Aseres and Etshuva from the beginning of the year. The Gemara's intention is that people should be careful not to waste their money. Shouldn't waste money. And that's what he says, that true, it is his gula for Ashiris, that the husband should spend money on his wife. He shouldn't be stingy, but it should be within reason. It shouldn't be in a ridiculous fashion. The Talmud says, what does it mean? Oivis ishtek kigufa, he has to love his wife like he loves himself. The Talmud understands that the pasuk that reads in the Chumash, that you should love your friend as you love yourself, is not to be taken. It doesn't mean that you should love all Jews to the same extent. Every Jew I have to love to the same extent that the Haftarach Kamocha, the same as myself. No, it's not so. A child loves parents more than he loves other people, or does not love parents as much, whatever the case happens to be. Whatever the situation happens to be, your brothers and sisters love each other, or don't love each other to the same extent as the neighbors love each other, and so on. So the Talmud says the highest degree of love should be between a husband and a wife. It's not stand that they happen to be living together in the same apartment, but that's it. But he really loves someone else, and she really has a crush on a different man. No, the Talmud says you should be careful in advance. Make sure you marry, the boy should marry a girl, and the girl should marry a boy, that they should love each other and not be in violation of this mitzvah. The Talmud says that if one marries before meeting the girl, so he will be, this is prohibited. You're not allowed to, let's say you'll just get a shatchan to arrange for a marriage and you never met the girl, you don't even know if you're going to like her. The girl doesn't know if she's going to like you. So the Talmud says that this is highly improper because they will probably be in violation later in married life. They'll be in violation of the mitzvah of Yahavtah Rav Kamecha. What do you mean Yahavtah Rav Kamecha? So love other people. So the Talmud understands you're not supposed to love other people. The husband and the wife are supposed to love each other to the highest extent possible. That's what the Talmud says, Oivis ishta kigufoi, that the husband and the wife have to love each other to the highest degree. The Iker pasuk, we have to love kamoicha, it really applies to all Jews, but to different degrees. So the married couple, the spouses, are supposed to have the highest degree of love. Umechabda yoisim igufa means about spending money on each other. The obligations involved in marriage, the Talmud stresses very much, are all reciprocal. There are obligations that the husband has towards the wife, and obligations that the wife has towards the husband. The Chumash only mentions in Parshas Mishpatim, the Chumash puts together three of these obligations in a negative fashion. It says in the Chumash that Sheir Uksusa V'Yonasa Lo Yigra, that the husband should be careful not to cheat his wife in these three areas. What are the three areas? So the simple translation of the words in the Chumash seems to imply Sheira means that he should give food to his wife. He's obligated to support her. Ksusa means he has to buy clothing. Ksus. And onasa means tashmish amita, married, like a married couple who live together. That's one time in the Gemara says that this is the simple translation, and this is how the Rambam paskens in his Yarech HaZokeh, that the husband is obligated to support his wife and to buy her clothing, not only to lead a married life together, but to support his wife and buy her clothing. This is a biblical obligation. Most of the Tanoim in the Talmud disagree with this opinion, and most of the Rishonim have not accepted the Rambam's opinion. And they understand that the obligation, that it's clear the husband has an obligation to support his wife, to give her food and clothing and a place to live, this is only midirabbanan. It's interesting. This is only midirabbanan. It's not an obligation in Torah, but it's the chapasik in Chumash. It doesn't say sheir uksusim and asalot. So the Ramban HaChumash, the Talmud never explains how do you reinterpret the words of the Chumash. So the Ramban in his commentary on Chumash, on Parashas Mishpatim, explains how do the other rabbis understand the pasuk. So he says, no, oinasa means the marital relations between the husband and the wife. Sheira and ksusa are related to oinasa. Ksusa means simply, let's say the woman doesn't simply want to be with her, let's say the woman wears dresses all day long. Then at night, she's interested in having fancy garments when she's going to be with her husband. She doesn't just want to take off her clothes and be with her husband as if she's being used by him or being attacked with him. Or let's say they have very cheap furniture. So she feels very uncomfortable about that. She'd like to have a fancy Italian provincial or something, some fancy furniture in the bedroom that should make her feel more comfortable, that she's not being used by her husband. So the Ramban says that is what is meant by the pasuk, Sheira ksusa v'onasa. Onasa means the marital relations, and the ksusa means the ksus that she insists that her husband should buy her when she is together with him. And the sheira has to do also with sheira basar. All has to do with onasa. Everything has to do with the obligation, the marital obligations that they have towards each other. This is a reciprocal obligation. Let's say the wife does not want to be with her husband, and the husband does not want to be with the wife. So either party is in violation of their obligation. This is an obligation in either direction. So the Ramban, and this is the opinion of most Rishonim, they feel that the obligation of the husband to support his wife with food, clothing, and a place to live is only rabbinical in nature. It's not a biblical obligation. What's the difference whether it's rabbinical or biblical? So the Shulchan Aruch comes up, the commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch do come up with the difference. Let's say, for example, the following situation. A couple is married and the husband is not well and he's not able to lead a normal married life with his wife. He goes to work and so on, but he's not able to lead a married life with his wife. So the wife says, what kind of a marriage is that? The wife has a right to say, or let's say the wife is sick and she's not able to have marital relations with her husband. The husband says, that's not fair. That's not a normal marriage. If she's just sick for a month or two or half a year or something, so you have the medical treatment, you can take care of it. What happens if the doctors say this is a condition that is going to last for years and years and years? So the Talmud says clearly that if either party is unable to live up to their marital obligations, so the other party is entitled to ask for a get. They want to marry someone else. We'll be able to lead a normal married life. So the question is, what happens if you have a couple who are happily married, more or less happily married, but then the husband loses his job, and he's simply unable to support his wife. He's unable to buy her food and clothing, and they're going to have to schnorr money in the street. They're going to have to ask for nedarim. So does the wife have the right to demand a get? Because she says the husband is not living up to his part of the marital obligation, so she wants to marry a man who will be able to support her. Or should we perhaps assume no? The obligation to support the wife is not really intrinsic to the marriage. There are lots of obligations in life, but this is not really a marital obligation. This is a side obligation. So in the Shulchan Aruch, the Poskim assume that this would depend on the nature of the obligation. If it's biblical in nature, then we assume that the Pasuk in Mishpatim, is defining that these are the three marital obligations. And just like if the husband is not able to live up to the aspect of Tashma Shamit, or the wife is entitled to a get, so too if the husband is unable to support his wife or to buy her clothing, so she would be entitled to a get. She says he's not living up to his marital obligation. But the way we pass from Halacha, that the obligation of the husband to support his wife is only rabbinical in nature, so if he can't afford anything, they're going to have to live off of tzedakah. This per se would not be a taina on the part of the wife that she should insist on a get. If he can't afford, he can't afford. But they're still married together. There was an interesting dispute in the days of the Balei HaTosfos. The Tosfos in Ksuvos records this dispute. How is one to understand the nature of the obligation of the husband to support his wife? What does that mean? Does it mean that if the husband has a job and he earns enough money and he's able to buy his wife food and clothing and rent a nice apartment, he's obligated to do so? But let's say he sits in the kollel and he learns all day and he doesn't earn any money. So he can't afford anything. So he's not mechuyev. If he doesn't earn any money, he's not mechuyev. But he say, no, that's exactly what the obligation means. The husband is obligated to go get a job in order that he should be able to support his wife. If there are jobs available, we're talking a situation where there are jobs available. Is that included in the obligation of the husband that he has to go get a job in order to be able to support his wife? But he say, no. If he's earning money, he has to hand over a certain proportion of the money to the wife for the purpose of buying food and clothing. But if he doesn't earn any money, he's not mechuyev to go get a job. So this is a big dispute that the Rishonim had, and many Rishonim got very excited about this machlokes. Many of them thought that this was utterly ridiculous. What do you mean? The husband is not obligated to get a job to support his wife? Of course he is. So he said it's the chabizayim for the whole Kol Yisrael that any Rishon should have said like that. But this is a big machlokes in the Rishonim. Today it doesn't make a difference. Today this whole dispute is only theoretical anyway, because today whenever a fellow gets married, so in the ksuba we write down one of the obligations, we write vano efloch va'ekar ve'ezim afanis yisichidit. We write explicitly, I obligate myself to get myself a job and to support you and to give you food and clothing and a place to live. So even if a medina de gemara, even if based on the Talmudic law, the husband is not obligated to get himself a job, it's only if he's earning money, then he has to give a certain amount of that money to his wife, the food and clothing. But today, one is obligated to because the husband obligated himself to. He wrote that in the ksuba. The Mishnah tells us in Ksuvis that not only does the husband have an obligation to buy his wife clothing, let's say when the clothes wear out, when it comes to Yontif, the husband is obligated to buy his wife an additional malbush lekabed Yontif. That's the chelek of Simchas Yontif. The Pasuk says in Chumash, v'samachto on Yontif, there's an obligation of Simchas Yontif. So the Pasuk says, V'samachta ato uveisecho, many psukim says, the husband and the wife. What do you mean the husband and the wife? So the Talmud has a debate. Simcha should really be a mitzvah saseh shazman grom. Just like sitting in sukkah, blowing shofar, or shaking a lulav is a mitzvah that has to do with a specific time. And women are not obligated to fulfill these mitzvahs if they don't want to. If they choose to, they don't have to listen to tefillah shofar, and they don't have to sit in the sukkah if they don't want to, because it's a zman grama. So the Talmud has a big dispute. What do you do over here? Here is a pasuk that speaks of Simchas Yontov, and it says, "If samachta ato ovei secha." It sounds like the women are obligated in simcha just like the men. So some opinions in the Talmud have it. There's a dispute. The Rambam and the Ravid also had a paskin on this issue. So some opinions in the Tanoim hold that this is an exception to the rule, that even though Simchas Yontov is a zman grama, nonetheless, women are obligated. And in other opinions in the Gemara are not so. It's not that the women are obligated to observe the mitzvah of Simchas Yontov. Isha baila misamchus, the husband, it's a chelik of the husband's obligation of Simchas Yontov, that he should be misamech his wife by whatever will make her happy. So the Talmud says in Eretz Yisrael, they used to buy their wives white dresses, and Echut and Bovel used to buy their wives colored dresses. Whatever the minhag hamakom is, that's considered a dover hamisameach. The Talmud says for children, you don't give them basar v'yayin, they won't enjoy that. So you buy them candies, you buy them toys, whatever will be misameach children. And if you had men in the family, whatever will be misameach men, basar, yayin, whatever. And women, whatever will be misameach women. Some women enjoy fancy dresses, some women enjoy jewelry, whatever it happens to be. So on every yontif, the husband has an obligation to buy something extra for his wife. That is a chelik of his mitzvah. That's the way he should fulfill the mitzvah of Simchas Yontif, by buying his wife something extra. Some say that that's the kavanah. The Talmud says in several places that Rosh Chodesh is a yontif for women. What's the reason why it's a yanta for women? So the Medrash says because the women refuse to participate in the Chet HaEgel. Originally, when the Jews were interested in making an Egel Hazor, the Golden Calf, so the men donated a lot of money. They were called upon to donate, so they donated a lot of money. And the women didn't want to give their jewelry, not because it was their jewelry. No, when it came, they would have given, if it would be a worthy cause, they would give a haraya. And when it came to building the Mishkan, the women came and they donated their jewelry just the same as the men. The difference was that the women knew how to discern a worthy cause from a non-worthy cause. Today you have a lot of stuff. Everybody's making a parlor meeting and raising money for this organization, for that organization, and some of the organization are raised give off in the guilt, you're wasting your money. There are people who donate money to dog hospitals, and they donate money to all kinds of secular institutions, and all kinds of chaloyim roim, what... And other people know how to place their money in the right places, to give to the right tzedakas and to give to the worthwhile organizations and the worthwhile institutions. So the Talmud and the Medrash points out that the men of Klal Yisrael at the time of Yetzias Mitzrayim, they were very generous. Whenever anybody would ask for money, so they would donate. Mitzvoyim le'egel v'nosim, mitzvoyim le'mishkan v'nosim. They asked them to give a donation, they were making an avodah zarah, make out a check. We're making a Beis HaMikdash, make out a check, they always make out a check. They give the same $180, whether it's a Beis HaMikdash or it's a Beis HaVodah Zarah, it doesn't make a difference. And the women knew how to discern. Oh, it's a good cause, they're going to give their own jewelry. It's a negative cause, like Chet HaEgel, they're not going to give a penny. They're not going to give theirs, they're not going to allow theirs, they're going to try to prevent their husbands from giving. So when was the Mishkan finally built? So the Mishkan was completed on Rosh Chodesh Nisan. So the Medrash says that because Rosh Chodesh Nisan was the day of Chanukah HaMishkan, the first day, Rishon, of the Chanukah HaMishkan, so that's why it was sort of accepted that every Rosh Chodesh, the women celebrate Rosh Chodeshim as a yontif. It's the yontif of knowing how to discern properly where to give your tzedakah. Special yontif for the women. So what does that mean, that it's a yontif for women? What do the women do? So the Minhagim, the Talmud says the women have a minhag. They don't sew and they don't do the type of it, stitch, they don't do a major malachas. They cook food, like on Yontif, you cook food also, but whatever malachas a woman wouldn't do. And Chol HaMoed, so many women have such a minhag, they don't do these malachas on Rosh Chodesh as well. So al derech halotza, some say that that's what it means, that every Rosh Chodesh is a Yontif for the women, because the Mishnah says in Ksuvos that on every Yontif the husband is obligated to buy his wife another dress, and if Simchas Yontif, so every Rosh Chodesh is a Yontif for the women, so you should buy your wife a dress on every Rosh Chodesh. Yeah, it's true. If a person can afford it, and that's the way his mother did, or that's the way his wife's family did, so this taka did like that. How many dresses does a wife have a right to buy? Or how much jewelry should the husband buy his wife? If she enjoys jewelry, some women don't enjoy jewelry, but if they do enjoy it, some women enjoy books, whatever the woman enjoys, so how much is the husband obligated to do? So the Talmud says the klal is, the higher of the two standards, whatever was practiced in his family or in her family. The Talmud speaks of the two obligations that each has towards each other. The husband, the reciprocal obligations of kavod. The husband is obligated to be mechabed his wife, and the wife is obligated to be mechabed the husband. Isn't it a little bit contradictory? Each one is obligated to be mechabed the other one. So if you look a little more carefully in the Talmud, they don't have the same meaning. The husband's obligation to be mechabed his wife really means to spend money on his wife, that he shouldn't be stingy. He should spend money on his wife for whatever is necessary to make her happy, whatever is reasonable, whatever is the minig amdina, whatever was the minig by his family or by her family. That's the chiyuv to be mechabed his wife. The wife's obligation to be mechabed her husband doesn't mean that she should spend money. In the days of the Talmud, the wife didn't have any money. Well, the husband was earning all the money. The wife was staying home. She didn't have her own job. She wasn't earning her own salary. So what does it mean the wife is mechiyuv to be mechabed her husband? So it means a different thing. It means that the wife has an obligation to help the husband out in his business, if she can possibly do that, or if she can. Let's say he's a rabbi. So what, you're going to help him out? She's going to write his drushes for him. So if she knows how to write a drushes, so good. So let's help him out. Or if she can't help him out in his business and his panosis, so she should encourage him on, and she should cheer him up and help him function well. Or the Talmud says, the Rambam points this out, based on a passage in the Talmud, the wife has an obligation to be mechabed her husband, that she should admire her husband and look up to him, if there's what to look up to. So the Talmud says that the couple should be careful to marry in such a way that the wife should have what to look up to in the husband. The Talmud says a person should always, when he's looking for a shidduch, the Gemara says in Yimam, is nechos dargo and a sivit sada. A boy should always go down a madrega and marry a girl. Shouldn't marry the daughter of the greatest Talmud Chacham in the world. She's going to think her father was the last great Talmud Chacham in the world, and her husband is a nobody. There are people who had the misfortune of marrying daughters of very great Talmid HaChamim, who were never respected by their wives, and the wife treated the husband like a dirt. You're a nothing, you're a nobody. My father was the greatest God, and you're a nobody. And even if the husbands were greater than their fathers, they didn't realize it. They thought their father was the greatest in the history of the world, so they didn't respect the husband. So the Talmud says, you should always be careful about that. Always marry a girl who's slightly on a lower level of society, so that the wife will look up to her husband and respect him. The Rambam claims, the Rambam understands that suggestion that the Gemara has is based on the understanding that the wife has an obligation to be mechabed her husband. Mechabed means to look up to the husband and to respect him as if he were a tsar, as if he were a prince. Of course, if he's a prince, she's a princess, but the relationship should be such. It's an interesting, we mentioned a few weeks ago, I think, in the Shulchan Aruch, they quote in Eben Ha'ezer, that there is a cherim hakadmonim, means in the days of the Balei HaTosis, they made a cherim against the husbands who beat up their wives. So what does that mean? I mean, until the days of the Balei HaTosis, it was permissible for a husband to beat up his wife. And only in the days of the Balei HaTosis, they introduced this prohibition. So obviously, that's not what it means. When you have something that is introduced as a cherim, it doesn't necessarily mean that up until that time, this was permissible, and that's the first time that they prohibited it. For example, the Rabbeinu Gershom introduced a cherim for one who reads somebody else's mail. So you mean to say until the days of Rabbeinu Gershom it was permissible to read someone else's mail? Of course not. But the Rabbeinu Gershom introduced a cherem against one who divorces his wife bal korcha. You mean until the days of Rabbeinu Gershom it was permissible? I marry a girl and she let's say, and I learn in the kollel for 10 years and she's working ahead of, and she's supporting me and she's raising the children, and then after I get myself a nice job, then I decide this girl is a dope. She's an idiot. What do I need her for? I trade her in and I get myself a young chick. So there's no Issa Deraisa in divorcing my wife against her wishes. Of course, that's terrible. That's deceitful. How can you use a girl for all the years that I needed her, I was using her, and then later on I divorce her without her consent? So of course there's an Issa Deraisa. That's terrible. The Rabbeinu Gershom added on a cherem. A cherem means a curse. A klola. The Gemara says that cherem is the same osios as ramach. Ramach, the 248 evorim that the human body has. So the Talmud says a cherem is a curse that should be nichnas into the ramach ivorim of a person. So the Rabbeinu Gershom added on that if somebody reads somebody else's mail, he introduced a klola, a curse, that the man should drop dead. Or if someone divorces his wife bal korcha, so he introduced a cherem that the man should drop dead. Until the days, Rabbeinu Gershom was also understood that it's highly improper. But he was the one who introduced a cherem. So here also, when they quote in the Shulchan Aruch, in the end of Eben Ezra, that there is a cherem hakadmonim, then in the days of the Balei HaTosis, the rabbis introduced a cherem against the husbands who beat up their wives. So it does mean that until that time it was permissible, it was clearly forbidden to beat up one's wife. But it wasn't a curse that the man should drop dead. And the rabbis felt at that time, around the year 1100, 1200, they felt that it was getting out of hand. Imagine. In the year 1100, 1200, they felt that things were getting out of hand. So they introduced a curse. They cursed any man who would beat up his wife. The Talmud points out that not only is a man obligated to be careful not to beat up his wife, he has to be careful not to humiliate her, not to scream at his wife too much. The Talmud says that sometimes a husband has an obligation to discipline. The nature of marriage used to be clearly different from the way it is today. So sometimes it was the obligation of the husband to discipline his wife. So the Talmud says sometimes a husband has to scream at his wife and make believe that he's angry. He should never get angry. The Talmud says speaks about disciplining children or one's wife. So the Talmud says, Bayas usually disciplining children. Bayas, the husband doesn't discipline his wife. It's a whole different nature of the marriage. But let's say disciplining children. So the Talmud says you're not allowed to get angry at the children. You have to put on an act as if you are angry. The children should think that the parents are angry, but they shouldn't really be angry in their heart. So the Talmud says the same is true regarding disciplining one's wife. In the days of the Talmud where that was possible. So the Gemara says that women will usually, in the traditional style of a woman will usually be brought to tears if humiliated much quicker than a man. So the Talmud says that a man has to be very careful, especially with his own wife, more so than with someone else's wife, because she's going to take it to heart more than someone else's wife, not to humiliate his wife, not to cause her to cry. Because this is an Isser of Einoz Dvar, to cause anyone pain or aggravation. Is a separate Isser of Einoz Dvar. The Gemara says you have to be especially careful. To beat up his wife is Dachman Chashmeh. Of course it's also, but even to cause aggravation by screaming or by being too stern or too strict. So the Talmud says you have to be very careful. This is a clear violation of the din of Einoz Dvar. The Medrash has an interesting comment on the pasuk in the beginning of Zaysa Bracha Shaderach Moshe Isha Elikim as Bnei Yisrael. Moshe Rabbeinu gave brachas to the Jewish nation before he died. So the expression used by the Chumash is Moshe Rabbeinu was an Isha Elikim. He was a man of God. And he gave these brachas. What kind of an expression is that, Isha Elikim? He's a holy man, a man of God. So the Medrash has Medrash Tanchuma. It's not a Chassidish Sefer. Medrash Tanchuma writes on that pasuk, Isha Elikim means the husband of the Shechina. What kind of a lashon is that? As if Ki'ilu, as if the Shechina were marrying to Moshe Rabbeinu, as if HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the wife, as if Moshe Rabbeinu is the husband, what does that mean? What do you mean Moshe Rabbeinu tell to his brachas? Who is he to give a bracha? Well, he's going to see to it. Moshe Rabbeinu is going to die at the age of 120. So who's going to see to it that the brachas are going to be mekuyim? He's going to be lying under the Ribbono Shel Olam, that the Ribbono Shel Olam should listen to his brachas. Why does the Ribbono Shel Olam have to listen to his brachas? So the Medrash uses an expression that Ezel Hishik Sheira Kol Shoyser Ritzon Gadol. If you have a married couple, and the wife is a good wife, so she will be obedient, she will listen to the husband's requests. So Moshe Rabbeinu was giving brachas to Bnei Yisrael, so because he was the Ish Elokim, he was, so to speak, as if he were the husband of the Shechina, so the Shechina was an obedient wife, HaKadosh Baruch Hu would act like an obedient wife and listen to whatever Moshe Rabbeinu had requested. So Moshe Rabbeinu is giving brachas, so the Shechina will comply. This appears in the Talmud as well. There's a famous story in the end of Nedarim where the Gemara says there was a couple who came from two different sections of Eretz Yisrael, where they spoke a different dialect of Hebrew, and the husband and the wife didn't really communicate well. So whenever the husband would say what he's interested in having for supper or whatever, the wife would always, she loved him very much and she wanted to please him, but she never knew what he was driving at. So he said he wanted fleishik, she would give milchik, fleishik. He never understood. She never understood what he wanted. So the husband, in exasperation, one day said she should take the leichter. And she was a tmimistik, a young wife. She didn't know, she didn't realize that she wasn't satisfying his needs. So he said, take the candlestick and hit it over the bovo. And she didn't know that in the Aramaic Hebrew that he spoke from his section of Eretz Yisrael, bovo means the gate of the house. And he was so angry, he wanted her to take the candlestick and bang it on the gate of the house because he was angry. She didn't know what the word Bava meant, but it happened at that moment that Tana was walking by in the street whose name was Bava Ben Buta. So the husband gives up. The husband hastened that she should take the candlestick and hit it over the Bava. So she went out in the street and she took the Tmimus back. Obviously she was missing a couple of marbles. She wasn't all there. She walked out in the street with the candlestick and she pops it over the Tana's head. So he turns around, the Tana turns around and says, young lady, what is this all about? So she says to him, it's me, Miss. My husband told me I should take the candlestick and hit it over the bubble. So the Tana already understood what happened. obviously there was a confusion, the word bavon, the word bavon. So he didn't get too angry at her, but he just gave her a bracha. He said she should be good ben, she should have wonderful children. And he said that expression that's quoted in the Shulchan Aruch, Eizeh Hishek Sheira, Kol Sha'isav Itzayim Baila. That she's a wonderful, she was obviously not so bright, but he said she's a good wife, that she tries to listen, she tries to obey what her husband says. So what is the Gemara driving at? This is quoted in the Shulchan Aruch, that it's an obligation of the wife to be obedient to the husband. What does it mean to be obedient? And if the husband has an idea that makes sense, so then the wife should listen. If it makes sense that she's not listening to the husband, so she thinks that it makes sense. The husband here requested of his wife, she thought that he had requested of the wife that she should bop the Tana over the head, which was an unreasonable request. And still the Tana gave her a bracha and he said, you're a good wife, that you do what your husband requested of you, even though you don't agree with him, even though you think that it's wrong. Now, in that case, I'm to be an Aveira. If that's what she really thought, that her husband had requested, obviously she was missing a couple of marbles. So but she didn't realize that she's doing an Aveira. So she thought that she's being obedient, even to the extent of doing something that she didn't think was right. So that's what the Gemara is telling you. Not that the wife should do Aveiras, that the husband wants his wife to be Mechal Shabbos, or to violate the laws of Kashrus or something else. So she's not permitted to listen to the husband. But in life, sometimes there are situations where the husband has one opinion and the wife has another opinion. So the Talmud says that there a klal would be proper of the wife that she should give in to the husband. The Gemara has in Maseches Bav Metzia, Perek Azov, that one of the Amoraim, when he got married, made a deal with his wife that whenever there would be a dispute between the two of them regarding any matter, who would have the final say? They should discuss it together. So who would have the final say? It's going to be one-to-one. Who's going to have the final say? There's no Kosov HaShlishi Lachri over here. So one of the Amaroi made an agreement with his wife that in all matters of Lili Dialma, all worldly matters, the wife should have the final say. What color painting, or what color wallpaper, the rug, or furniture, whatever. And in all Lili Dishmai, in all religious matters, the husband have the final say. That was one of the recommended suggestions that you have in the Gemara. The story goes that Rabbi Saul Salanti, after being married for many years, told people that he made up such a deal with his wife, that when they first got married, they made up that all Mila Dishmai he'll have the final say, and all Mila Dalma she will have the final say. And he says, surprised that they're married over 30 years and no Mila Dalma ever came up. Everything, all issues came up, happened to be Mila Dishmai. Yeah, sometimes that happens to be the case, that there are no Mila Dalma. Yeah, but the person should be reasonable to understand. If one has such an agreement with his wife, which is not a bad agreement to have, if the husband is usually more learned than the wife, so he should be reasonable enough to determine that some of the matters in life are mili d'yama. Not everything is really mili d'shma. There are some things that are mili d'yama. Of course, one of the obligations that a wife has towards a husband is to give birth to his children and to raise the children. Mishnah says that if the woman refuses to become pregnant, or she doesn't want to have any more children, she only has one baby, that's it, she doesn't want to have any more children. So this is grounds for divorce. Grounds for divorce means that she's in violation of her obligation in the marriage, and the husband can divorce her without giving her any ksuba. Of course, this is only by medvar mamurim if they got married. At the time that they got married, it was understood they are going to have children, or nothing was understood, they didn't discuss it. What if they got married, melechatchila, and they made up they're not going to have any children, which is against halacha, they're not allowed to, but at the time that they got married, they made up, that's it. They're not going to have children for the next 20 years. Then they'll think about it after that. So then later on, the husband decides he wants to be frum, he wants to have children. Watch this, what are you talking about? But when we got married, that was the agreement, that we're not going to have children for the first 20 years. So then it's not grounds for divorce. But whenever they didn't make anything up at the time of marriage, so it's assumed that that's one of the obligations of the wife in marriage, which by definition is that the wife should bear the children of the husband. It doesn't mean the wife is obligated to be religious. The wife is obligated to be religious in halachot. Let's say the woman decides she doesn't want to be shomer Shabbos anymore. That's not grounds for divorce. If the husband is unhappy that he's married to a woman who's mechal Shabbos, she's not so observant in certain laws of the Torah. She's not so medactic in some of the mitzvahs of Torah. She doesn't daven all the time, whatever it is. So that's not grounds for divorce. If the husband is unhappy because she's not on the same religious level as he is, so let him divorce her, but let him pay her the ksuba. That's not grounds for divorce. Grounds for divorce is only when the woman is in violation of the agreement, of the marriage agreement. So part of the marriage agreement is that she's going to have children. That's understood, even if they never spoke about it, unless they specifically said otherwise. Or the Mishnah has, part of the marriage agreement is that a married woman has to act with this married husband also, a married man, The couple have to act with a certain degree of tznius, that the woman has to dress in a proper fashion, she shouldn't walk around half undressed in public, and the married women should cover their hair in public places, and the women shouldn't speak in a pritzdika fashion. These are all what's considered as pritzdika way of speaking. It depends on whatever the minhag hamdina is. Whatever is considered unacceptable, so is considered pritzdika. So the Mishnah considers this part of the obligations of the marriage. This is not stama a zaitigit thing that people should act in its nizdika fashion. This is part of the obligations of the marriage. But if the woman decides she doesn't want to be shamishabes anymore, so she's not allowed to decide that, but that's been auto mamakum. That has nothing to do with the husband. If the husband decides that he's unhappy about that, so for that, in that instance, he has to, if he wants to divorce, he has to pay her the ksuba. The Mishnah has a strange statement. If the woman is noderis ve'ena mikayemis, the wife keeps on taking the dharma, she always violates the nidar. Whenever she gets angry, she says, she takes a neder, she's never going to go to the ladies' auxiliary. She's not going to go to the Mizrahi anymore. She's not going to daven a shul anymore. Then the next week she forgets about it and she violates all of the shuas that she takes. Or she takes a neder, she keeps on taking a pledge, she's going to give to this tzedakah, a pledge to give to that tzedakah, and she never lives up to the pledge. So one would have thought that this is a talk. What does this got to do with the marriage? Keeps on taking the dharma and violating them. This is certainly an extraneous thing for the marriage. So the husband will not have the right to divorce his wife. There's not grounds for divorce, and if he decides that he's unhappy married to such a woman, he should have to pay her tzedakah. If he wants to divorce his commission, says, no, there is ve'enim mikayemis. If the woman takes the dharma shuas and she's in violation of them, so this is grounds for divorce, and the Gemara asks why. It's like Chil Shabbos. What has it got to do with the marriage agreement? So the Gemara says, because Bavoy Nedarim, Bonim Mason, that if the parents keep on taking Nedarim, they pledge to give Tzedakah, they're taking Dharma Shavuos, and they violate their pledges, they violate their Shavuos, so this may Chalila cause the children to die. So having children is one of the obligations of the marriage. The wife is obligated to the husband to supply him with children. That's a move on Me'elev, that's understood, that's self-understood, that's what marriage is all about. So if the wife is prepared to give birth to children, to raise the children, but she's in violation of the Dharma all the time, so that's considered as if she may possibly be putting her children's lives into Sakana. So that's why the Mishnah considers it in violation of one of the obligations of the marriage. It's interesting, the Mishnah also has another example. These are both by the husband and the wife. The Mishnah has to give in the case of the Talmud points out not only, and Shulchan Aruch says, not only is there an obligation of kibbutz towards one's natural parents, towards in-laws also, there is an obligation of kibbutz. So the Mishnah considers it not only a mitzvah of kibbutz, a zaitig mitzvah, like Shvira Shabbos. No, if the wife doesn't observe Shabbos, that's not grounds for divorce. If he wants to divorce, he has to pick suva. No, kibbutz towards their parents or the in-laws is considered crucial to the marriage. Because part of the marriage is to have children, and part of the having children is that the children should look up to their parents. That's a normal marriage, that's a normal family. And why should the children look up to their parents if they don't respect their parents? Or if the husband is disrespectful to his in-laws, or the wife is disrespectful to her in-laws. So that's why the Mishnah considers disrespect to parents. Talmud points out not only, and Shulchan Aruch says, not only is there an obligation of kibbutz towards one's natural parents, towards in-laws also, there is an obligation of kibbutz. So the Mishnah considers it not only a mitzvah of kibbutz, a zaitige mitzvah, like Shmir Shabbos. No, if the wife doesn't observe Shabbos, that's not grounds for divorce. If he wants a divorce, he has to pick suva. No, kibbutz towards their parents or the in-laws is considered crucial to the marriage. Because part of the marriage is to have children, and part of the and having children is that the children should look up to their parents. That's a normal marriage. That's a normal family. And why should the children look up to their parents if they don't respect their parents? Or if the husband is disrespectful to his in-laws, or the wife is disrespectful to her in-laws. So that's why the Mishnah considers disrespect to parents or in-laws as essential and crucial to the marriage. And if one of them is in violation of the law in Yonim of Kibbutz Aviyim by parents or by in-laws, so this is considered a violation of the marriage contract. It's a violation of the Aseres Hadibus also. But in violation of the laws of Shabbos and Aseres Hadibus is not grounds for divorce. It's considered more than that. It's considered essential to the definition of the... it's crucial to the definition of the marriage. These are usually assumed to be the two major sources of friction in marriage. The respect or the lack of respect for in-laws. And the money fights. Usually the people who are involved in marriage counseling or the rabbanim who deal with gittin a lot, they say that all of the gittin, the overwhelming majority of the gittin are due to these two issues. The fact that someone is a little too cheap on the money, the husband usually is too cheap on the money, or because of the fact that there's disrespect towards the in-law. It takes a while, it's difficult. When a person gets married and is used to giving all of the respect to his parents, he calls his mother mom and he calls his father papa, whatever. Then all of a sudden he marries the boy, the girl marries someone else, and they have to call the in-laws mama, pops. It's not my mother, it's not my father. How can I call them mommy or daddy or something like that? So that's what the halacha says, that you're not allowed to call them, let's say, my father-in-law is Rabbi Shapiro, my mother-in-law is Rabbi Shapiro, so I get married. So I used to call my father-in-law Rabbi Shapiro, so he felt very hurt. He wants me to call me daddy, or pop, or tata, or something like that. My mother-in-law didn't want to be called Rebetzin Shapiro. She wanted me to call her mom, or something like that. And it was disrespectful on my part to call her by Rabbi Shapiro, Mrs. Shapiro. So that's required. Mitam kibbutz, mitam the shibud of the marriage, that you have to call them by an endearing lashon, the way they would like to be known. That's part of the din of kibbutz. The Talmud also has in the end of Tainus, the Talmud quotes Tanoim who say, one Tana has a brisa, Ein Isha Ela Lebonim, that the main purpose why God created women is in order to give birth to children. Another Tana, it's an exaggeration, another Tana has an expression, Ein Isha Ela Leofi, that women were only brought into this world, people only marry women, that they should dress up nicely. Another Tana has an expression, Ein Isha Ela Letachshitim, that women, the main purpose of women is that they should wear jewelry. What do you mean the main purpose is to wear jewelry? What the Talmud means to say is, that just like a woman, part of the marriage obligation is that a woman, it's understood, has to give birth to children to her husband. And if she decides after the marriage to tell her husband she's not interested in becoming pregnant, she doesn't want to have any children, she wants to have a career and not have any children, so the Mishnah says that she's in violation of the understanding of the marriage. So too, it's understood that the girl is supposed to dress nicely, not only when they're going out on dates in order to land her husband, she has to dress nicely during the entire time that they're married together with Yofi and Tachshita. She has to nemoise by the husband. And it's not only a one-sided deal, the same is true regarding the husband as well. The husband has, let's say, the wife comes back from the mikveh and she's all dressed up and all fancied up. And then the husband is a schlump. He hasn't taken a shower for the last month. And he's dirty and his fingernails are long and greasy and filthy and everything. So that's not right. The Talmud says that the husband has to nemoise by the wife also. This is an obligation. This is part of the obligations in a marriage. The Mishnah has that one of the obligations of the marriage are that Maisi Odeho Labailo. This often causes friction in marriage, that whatever assets, whatever money the wife earns, she's obligated to give over to the husband. What exactly does that mean? So in the days of the Talmud, the woman didn't go get a job to be a lawyer in a firm to make $150,000 a year. The woman would sit home and she would knit a little bit. And the Mishnah describes how much knitting she would make. She would earn $5 a week knitting, typing a firm paper or something like that. That was the whole extent of the work. So the Talmud says that the woman is supposed to give over the $5 a week that she earns to her husband in exchange for which the husband is mechuyev to support her and to take care of whatever her needs happen to be, even if they are clearly in excess of the $5 a week that she earns. What's going to be, 1 week she won't earn the $5? Or the food costs much more than the $5, so she should give the husband the $5 and he's mechuyev to give her the zaynus. But what happens if the wife has a job and she goes out of the house? She has a regular job, 9 to 5, she takes care of whatever she's obligated to take care of in the house. And she owns a fortune of money, and she wants to put this money away in her own bank account. So is it psychologically such a sound idea that the husband and wife should have a separate bank account? It's a different question. You have to ask a psychologist. But halachically, what if the wife is earning a lot of money? She doesn't want to give it over to the husband. So this is a big dispute in the Rishonim. What the din is? Is this included in the principle of Maisi de Ishtoi Lebailo? So the Dogel Mervover by the Nedib Yehuda in his commentary on the side of the Shulchan Aruch points out that the Mishnah Melech in his commentary on the Rambam points this out, that this is a major dispute in the Rishonim. And even though most of the Rishonim say that even then the wife is really obligated to give over all of the money to the husband, but nonetheless, since there is a minority opinion saying otherwise, and when the wife earns the money, she's the muchzik on the money, so she has the check. And if she wants, she can put it away in her bank account and she'll be vaita, she'll remain the muchzik. So whenever some person is muchzik, even though Rov says that you're supposed to give the money away, but the miut says that you can keep the money. So we have a klal, ein hocher b'mamon achar harov. The one who's muchzik, holding on to the money, can say, kim li ke review b'kitzer. In marriage, of course, you have to have a lot of understanding. That's understood. You have to have a lot of love. Oivis ishta kigufa. But each party has to understand that there are obligations, there are mutual obligations, and the more they understand that there are obligations, so we assume that maybe the marriage will be.
I want to thank Rabbi Schefter and again invite everybody a month from now, March 3rd, Rabbi Schefter's last lecture on the relationship of parents and children. Sure.
Okay, wonderful share. I don't think it's appropriate for Joe. I won't say many years, but I took a loaf of wine. And he was very anxious about it. In fact, my wife should worry that we're awake too long. So I was hanging around with him. So I said, but it says, the whom you shall go. So my wife.